question is, of course, where did light come from? When did it appear? Is it possible that we are alone in the universe? Or is it possible that living organisms appeared elsewhere in the universe, either independently of life on the Earth, or possibly as a result of life spreading from one planet to another, or even from one star to another? These are all questions that go back a long way. People have been thinking about them for centuries. And what Jeff and I have tried to do in the book is to pull together some of these ideas and to put them in context of some of the really exciting things that are happening in various parts of science at the moment, in chemistry, in biology, molecular biology, astronomy, physics. Many, many fields of science are starting to pull together now in all sorts of exciting ways to give us a glimpse of the kinds of things that might have happened. The first slide shows a possible solar system beginning to form around a star that's not very far away from our own. That funny-looking thing you see in the middle is actually a device that astronomers use to block out the blinding light from the star itself. The stuff that you see around the edges is the beginnings of a coalescing solar system, a solar system in the very earliest stages of formation. Now, up to just a few years ago, all this was speculative, and it's now enormously exciting that through the Hubble Space Telescope and other very large telescopes, it's now possible to actually see these solar systems beginning to form. We have, until recently, only been able to speculate about the early stages of the formation of the solar system. One such speculation is shown here. At the very beginning of the formation of our solar system, planetesimals and other small objects began to coalesce out of the tremendous cloud of gas, dust, and small rocks that was circling around the sun during its during the sun's early formation, which began something over 4 billion years ago. These planetesimals, as they began to grow together, bits began to fall on them. They began to get bigger and bigger, and eventually, these planetesimals got large enough that they began to collide with each other, and sometimes their collisions were quite violent. So that you can see here a situation in which one planetesimal is colliding with another one. And as time went on, more and more of these lumps of rock grew to the point where we actually had the beginnings of the family of planets that we see around the sun now. And it is that kind of thought in the previous slide, actually going on around a star not very far away from us in our own stellar neighborhood. As time went on, rather dramatic things happened. For example, the moon formed as a result of a collision of the Earth and a very large planetesimal, probably about the size of Mars. When the Earth collided with this enormous planetesimal, essentially much of the Earth was destroyed, much of the planetesimal was destroyed, and a big ring of lightish material, rocks and gas, formed around the Earth from which the moon coalesced. And we can see there on the left of this particular picture the moon beginning to accrete, all sorts of objects crashing into it. There's one you can see there that's just hit the moon, beginning to come together out of this circle of materials around the Earth. And you've got another view here from the moon, perhaps, which at that point was very hot because all these rocks came crashing in and heated the moon up. The moon looking at the Earth, a very lurid-looking object in the sky indeed, looking very different from the Earth of today. The fascinating thing, of course, is that the Earth was an extremely different place from the Earth that we know. The Earth of about 4 billion years ago was very, very different from the Earth of today. We cannot imagine present-day life living on the Earth of about 4.5, 4.6 billion years ago, when the solar system was just forming. The Earth was hot. The atmosphere was extremely different from the atmosphere of today. There was no liquid water on the Earth because it would all have been vaporized. The Earth was indeed extremely different. As things began to cool down and the oceans began to form on the Earth, conditions began to change. And it was these changing conditions that are particularly interesting, because once you've got temperatures down to the point, the Earth, of course, was cooling, the rocks weren't falling out of the sky at quite the same frequency that they were early in the Earth's formation, things were beginning to calm down. They were still pretty hectic, but they were beginning to calm down. During this span of time, that lasted from about 4.5 to 4 billion years ago, that's 4,000 million years ago, during this span of time, all kinds of impacts happened, but the frequency of the impacts began to drop. The temperature of the Earth began to drop to the point where oceans could form. Oceans probably formed and vaporized again quite a number of times during this period. Eventually, however, the Earth calmed down to the point where there was some reasonably long period of time during which life could begin. It is fascinating that as we look at the very oldest rocks on the Earth, which have been dated to about 3.8 billion years ago, there is some indication that that life was already present even at that early time. We're not certain of this because the evidence is indirect evidence. We can't find fossils of these early creatures or anything like that. But there is some indication that life may have formed as early as 3.8 billion years ago. This is a glimpse of what the world might have looked like during this early time. Oceans covered much of its surface. The continents had not even formed at that point. Most of the land surface of the Earth was scattered islands, scattered around the planet, forming and disappearing again beneath the waves as the ocean ceaselessly wore down the islands as they appeared through volcanic action, rather like happens in Hawaii today, only a great deal faster and a great deal more violently than the formation and the wearing down of the Hawaiian islands. So the same sort of thing was happening on the early Earth, but it was not a pleasant place to be. There was no free oxygen in the atmosphere. There were tremendous electrical discharges, we suspect, all the time, gigantic storms. We suspect that's true because even today there are enormous electrical storms taking place on the planet Jupiter. You don't see them because we always see the sun-illuminated side of Jupiter, but if you send a space probe to the other side of Jupiter, you can see great storms which essentially extend right from the poles to the equator of Jupiter. The whole planet is covered with gigantic electrical storms. And it is exactly these kinds of situations, this kind of situation, no oxygen in the atmosphere, probably a lot of other gases that we would find quite toxic ourselves, gases like methane, ammonia, very plentiful in the early atmosphere, electrical discharges and so on, that these conditions meant that the conditions on the Earth were, surprisingly enough, ripe for the emergence of life. And now Dr. Bader will take over here and tell you a little bit about the kinds of experiments that went on in the middle part of this century and subsequent to that time that allow us to see something about how life might, in fact, have arisen.
So as Chris said, the early Earth at this period was characterized by a much probably more hostile environment than we're used to thinking of today. We look out at the ocean today, we see a fairly tranquil sea, occasional big storms all off the sea, but in this particular time, the Earth was probably one giant, stormy, violent place. And this is the kind of conditions that were probably important in setting the stage for the chemistry that led to the formation of molecules that we think were important in eventually undergoing some sort of processing, chemical evolution to the first living entities. The first suggestion about how life may have begun on the Earth that was really a scientific breakthrough was published by a Russian biochemist, Alexandra Oparin. He first published a short pamphlet on this theory of prebiotic soup forming on an early Earth. And from this prebiotic soup, you had chemical evolution that produced more complex molecules that eventually led to something that we would call living. It's interesting that when Oparin first published this in 1924, he was a very young biochemistry student in Moscow. And even then, he had a lot of trouble with his senior professors accepting this. And he had to go through several rewrites of his manuscript before it was eventually published. He published a book that was translated into English. This is the cover of that book, and this was published in 1938. And it was widely read among Western scientists. So Oparin had a major impact here with respect to how we might conceive of chemistry setting the stage for the origin of life. Now, Oparin really never did any experiments to of significance. He was a great theorist. He was a very lucid writer. He was a very good spokesman for the field. But basically, even 30 years or so after, or 20 years or so after his book came out, there was no real experimental verification that this kind of process could take place on the early Earth. The idea being that you had gases in the atmosphere, such as methane, ammonia, hydrogen, or some combination of those. You had energy acting on those gases that somehow produced organic compounds. This changed in 1953 with the experiment that was published by Stanley Miller, who's also a professor here at UC San Diego and is in the audience today. Stanley, would you stand up? Stanley, in the book, we give some history of this classic experiment, and it's really an interesting story in itself. Stanley came to University of Chicago as a graduate student in 1952, and in the first month or two after he was at Chicago, he went to a lecture by Harold Urey, another very important member of the UCSD community, one of the founding fathers of UCSD. And in this lecture, Urey suggested that maybe people needed to look at the early Earth in a different way, sort of like Oparin did. Look at it with not components like CO2 and nitrogen, which some people were playing with, but rather look at the atmosphere as one that consisted of methane, hydrogen, and ammonia. And maybe using that model atmosphere, you could produce some interesting chemistry. Stanley listened to this lecture. But he decided that he really wanted to do theoretical work. So off he went, and he actually worked with Edward Teller for a year on studying the way elements were synthesized in stars. And luckily, Teller decided to leave for Berkeley about that time. And Stanley was from Berkeley. He got his undergraduate degree at Berkeley, and he didn't want to go back to Berkeley, so he wanted to stay at Chicago. So he went to Harold Urey and said, "Oh, I very much enjoyed your lecture, and I'd like to try an experiment that mimics a reducing atmosphere and some sort of energy source acting on that atmosphere." Urey was not very enthusiastic about this. Urey felt that this was too risky a project for a first-year, second-year graduate student, certainly unsuitable for a PhD thesis. But Stanley persisted, and Harold finally said, "Okay, I'll give you 6 months. Get some results in 6 months, and we'll see what happens." So the first thing they did was construct an apparatus. And the apparatus that they constructed looks like this. This isn't the actual apparatus, but it's a very close model of that. And you notice that the design of this is, at first glance, you might think sort of peculiar. There's a flask here with a bunch of brown gunk in it. There's another flask here with these electrodes sticking in it. But this was not an ad hoc design. It was a very carefully thought out design to mimic the cycle on the early Earth. This flask contained water. And when this started, of course, this liquid was clear. this was the ocean. Gases were introduced through this stopcock into this flask, and this would have been the atmosphere. this flask was heated, so there was a net evaporation from this into the atmosphere, and then there was a condenser hooked up here to recondense the stuff and bring it back to the ocean. So what you have here is a typical cycle on the Earth, evaporation from the ocean, interaction of gaseous components in the atmosphere. Those things get washed out of the atmosphere and end up back in the ocean. And so what they did here was simply load this flask up and apply an electric spark to this apparatus. And this was a very simple type electric spark. You just use a Tesla coil. I was afraid of that. It presents a good zap here. Can you see the spark on the electrode here? Okay. So the net effect of this was after a week, and Stanley asked Stanley why he used a week, and he says, oh, a week seemed like an appropriate length of time. The flask had turned this very brown, coffee-colored, gooey stuff in the atmosphere. Obviously, chemistry had taken place. Now, the question was this interesting chemistry? And Stanley had the foresight to realize that if the chemistry was going to really take place in this system, it would take place in the ocean. And so that's why this whole theory is so interesting. The oceans are an absolute intimate part of this. Without the oceans, this chemistry would be much more difficult, perhaps even impossible. So he took a sample of this water and analyzed it, and lo and behold, it contained a group of amino acids. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. And here was a beautiful example where you took very simple components, methane, ammonia, hydrogen, you put a spark on it, and not only do you make compounds, but you make compounds that are essential in biochemistry that we know as we know it. So this is a tremendous breakthrough. Later on, other people have studied variants of this, and we found all kinds of compounds that could be made under these conditions. The bases that make up DNA and RNA, some of those are readily made from this experiment. One of the abundant components of the ocean here is hydrogen cyanide, a deadly poison. So if you were walking down a beach 4 billion years ago, when all this chemistry had taken place, not only would you have been suffocated by the atmosphere, but if you'd have taken a drop of that ocean water, you'd have been a dead duck immediately. You'd have been poisoned by cyanide. So here was a model for how this chemistry could have taken place on the early Earth. Now, the next part of this story, I think, is equally interesting because this is a lab experiment. And one of the criticisms that always comes out of these kinds of experiments, does it really mimic nature? Does nature work this way? And of course, we have no record of this early period of Earth history. We can't go to rocks and look at rocks and ask the rocks to tell us whether this chemistry took place. So there was no clear-cut proof that this chemistry actually worked under natural conditions. That changed in 1969, in a very fortuitous thing. You remember 1969 was the year of the first Apollo landing on the moon. And one of the big efforts in the Apollo mission was to collect rocks, bring them back to Earth, and look for signs of life. So there was a lot of laboratories that had been set up to investigate lunar rocks for organic compounds thought to be important in life. Well, the bad news was that these rocks came back and they were about as clean as you could get. There was nothing in them. And so the whole Apollo missions with respect to looking for organic compounds was a bust. But then in September of 1969, a meteorite fell in a small town in southwestern Australia called Murchison. And the Murchison meteorite has become sort of the benchmark for showing that this kind of chemistry really does take place. It has taken place in the solar system. Because in the Murchison meteorite, you find many of the same compounds that Stanley made in the spark discharge experiment. It is a natural example that this chemistry has taken place in some asteroid out there in some place in the solar system. So we have good reasons to believe that the chemistry here has taken place. Whether it took place on the Earth or whether compounds were delivered to the Earth by meteorites and comets still is a point that people argue about. Now, the next thing we talk about in the book is how far can we go with this kind of chemistry. The compounds that you make are a long ways from life. Remember, life, as we know it, is made up of proteins that function as catalysts, enzymes, and genetic material in the form of DNA. We don't get anything close to that kind of complexity in these experiments. So we have to go beyond those simple compounds and start trying to figure out how to assemble these simple molecules into more complex molecules that eventually could satisfy the criteria for life. Now, I think it's important to emphasize at this point what we mean by life at the time of origin. Today, we see life everywhere. It's very complex life, multicellular life. We can look at life under a microscope. The life at the time of origin was inherently much, much simpler. Life at the time of origin had to satisfy basically two criteria. It had to replicate itself so information could be passed from one generation to the next, and that replication had to be imperfect. The reason it had to be imperfect is that allows mutations, some of which could be advantageous, the system would evolve. So the original life with respect to a simple self-replicating entity is also synonymous with the origin of biological evolution. They occurred at the same time. Now, how do you go from all of this gunk, this coffee-colored brown stuff, to compounds that can interact in a more explicit way? Well, one of the things we talk about in the book is a process called chromatography and geochromatography. Chromatography is a process that allows you to separate complex mixtures into simpler mixtures that can then react in a more explicit chemistry, more explicit way. Here's an experiment that you can do in your own house. This is the ink from one of these felt pens that we've crushed the pen, took the ink, and we've mixed that with beach sand. Well, you can see it's just black. We put that beach sand on the top of this column, and we let water drip through it. Look what happens. That's not black ink. It's ink that's composed of all of these colors. And so all of those colors have been separated on this simple little column with water simply dripping through sand. So on the early Earth, what we imagine is that this gunk that's produced in the experiment undergoes further processing, chromatography, separation, accumulation of compounds that are much more pure than you find in this mixture. And then these compounds themselves can interact with each other. And from this chemistry, you're going from simple, large complex mixtures to molecules that have more high degree of purity and that can interact in a specific way with each other. And I think what I'll do now is turn this back over to Chris, and he can talk about some of the chemistry that leads to the first protobionts, as we call them in the book, and then I'll come back and talk to you about extraterrestrial life.
So Jeff has brought you up to the point where you can begin to see some of the chemistry, some of the early chemistry that might have been involved in the origin of life. Now, we cheerfully admit, both of us, that there's a big gap here. There's a big gap between these simple compounds of the kind that Stanley Miller generated in his experiment and the extremely complicated things that make up even the simplest organisms. The simplest organisms that we know about, the only ones that the simplest creatures that we know that can live by themselves, that don't need to prey on something else like viruses, the simplest organisms that we know of that can live by themselves have something like 500 genes in them. 500 genes, each about 1,000 bases of DNA. We're talking about 500,000 bases of DNA, all strung out on that very, very long DNA molecule that you've seen so often, you know, in the pictures and read about in articles in magazines. The tremendous complexity of this molecule, and this, remember, is the simplest organism that we know about today, really raises a very important question. How do you get from the simple building blocks that we all agree now, scientists all agree, must have been present in the so-called primitive soup, this mix of molecules in the oceans in the early stages of the Earth's evolution? How do you get from that to something as complicated as a living organism? Everyone has a tough time with that, and so do we. But I hope you'll enjoy the part in the book where we speculate about how this might have happened, how we managed to jump across from one side, from the simple side, so to speak, to the very complex side. The way we visualize this happening is to assume that a kind of Darwinian process was going on. Now, even before there was life, now, we know, of course, that Darwin was talking about the evolution of living organisms when he wrote The Origin of Species. He was talking about how simple organisms became more complex over time because they came better and better adapted to more complex environments. And through, as we now know, through mutations and other changes, these organisms gradually evolved. But what kind of Darwinian process could have been going on before there was any life, before there were any living organisms? Somehow that seems like a prebiotic or before life Darwinism seems like an oxymoron. It doesn't seem like two terms that you should put together at all. It's difficult to imagine putting Darwin together with in a world where there was no life. And yet, Jeff has already given you a bit of an example here of the kinds of things that might have been going on in the early Earth that might have led to a kind of what we call proto-Darwinian evolution. And this proto-Darwinian evolution would take place as molecules were sorted out on rocks, on surfaces, finely divided surfaces like sand and so on. And these molecules gradually began to build up in various complicated and interesting ways. At the beginning, perhaps, whether a molecule survived or not really had something to do with whether it was washed off the rock that it was attached to. If it was attached to the rock, then it was all right, so to speak. If it was washed away, then it got lost back into the primitive soup. Anything could have happened to it. The sorting out process was one that didn't have anything to do with biology, didn't have anything to do with reproduction, not yet, but it did have to do with sorting things out and accumulating various kinds of molecules on the surface of the Earth. Once this happened, then quite possibly small little bits of genetic information, like tiny viruses, or perhaps even simpler than the simplest virus we know of, might have been able to replicate in these molecules, literally perhaps dining off these molecules. These small viruses perhaps began to prey on these collections of molecules and themselves begin to replicate, to make copies of themselves. Once that happened, you were over a big hurdle because now you've got some kind of system that could replicate itself. It wasn't a completely self-replicating system. It had to depend on all that proto-Darwinian sorting out still going on, but it was the beginning. And this incremental process of change is one that we think is approachable in the laboratory. It should be possible to construct lab experiments to ask, is it possible to recreate this kind of process in the lab, to go perhaps a step beyond the original Miller-Urey experiment and build up more and more complicated molecular ecosystems, non-living molecular ecosystems, that could eventually, within the lifetime of a few graduate students perhaps, could eventually lead to the much more elaborate proto-living molecules that we know must have appeared on the Earth at that time. All this probably happened fairly quickly. Calculations suggest that life probably arose within just a few thousand years, partly because if it had taken any longer, the primitive soup would have been eaten up by various physical processes. So this puts a bit of a constraint on life. It had to happen fast. The question of exactly how it happened we're still wrestling with. But the consequences of that are fascinating, because as we move out into the rest of the universe, we may find this going on, we may catch it in the process of happening, we may find the consequences of independent evolutions of life on other planets, and it is that exciting possibility that I'm going to turn it back to Jeff again, and he'll tell you about the kinds of things that we might be finding in the next few years as we begin to explore outer space.
Stanley and Harold Urey wrote something in 1959 where they said that finding evidence of life elsewhere would be a tremendous boost to understanding the origin of life on Earth, and they hoped that that would happen in the 20th century. Well, it didn't. So one of the things that we're very interested in is this kind of process unique to Earth. From what we see about the chemistry, the geology, all of the astronomy, all these things interacting, the Earth shouldn't be the odd planet out in this scenario. There should be other worlds where this chemistry has taken place. One of the problems that Chris and I had writing this book is that we wanted to talk about extrasolar planets. And we'd write it and we'd say, now there's 10, now there's 15. And by the time we'd go back and re-edit the thing, there were 25. And even now, we just finally threw up our hands and said, by the time you read this book, who knows how many planets that have been found. And right now, there's 50 different extrasolar planets that have been observed around stars. And some of these are truly solar systems with three or four planets in the systems. So planets are not unique to our solar system. There must be a multitude of worlds out there. So one of the challenges that we face is exploring our solar system, looking for possible evidence of life elsewhere and beyond. Now, I'm not going to talk about the beyond stuff today because it really is a field for astronomy. In fact, Chris and I went to a lecture last week on how you search these extrasolar worlds for possible evidence of life. Let's talk about our own solar system. If we look at the planets on our solar system, it's very easy to put X's on most of them. Mercury is just far too hot. Surface temperatures on Mercury are 600-800 degrees, too high. Venus right now also is a very hot world. Surface temperatures 500 to 600 degrees centigrade. You put an X on Venus, it's too hot. But Venus, when it was young, may have been a different story. From what we know about evolution of planetary systems, the sun was dimmer early in the history of our solar system. It wasn't nearly as bright. It wasn't nearly as hot. Venus could have been a more habitable world early in its history. We'll probably never know whether life ever began on Venus, because the surface temperatures are so hot today that it would have obliterated everything unless some H.G. Wells type organism making a living using silicon and other elements survives there. Earth, of course, we know life's here. Mars is the big question in everybody's mind. Whether life ever originated on Mars is an area that's been debated for nearly 150 years, and we still don't know the answer. You go further out, you used to think, okay, that's it. Nothing beyond Mars. Jupiter's a gaseous planet, Saturn likewise. It gets cold out there. Maybe chemistry there, but no life. Well, we now know that there are moons around Jupiter, one of which is called Europa, which probably has an extensive ocean covered by about 10 kilometers of ice. Europa is about the size of our moon, but it's estimated that the European Ocean is 100 kilometers deep. And you go through the calculation, that ocean on Europa is potentially as big as the ocean here on Earth. Is there life on Europa? That's a very interesting question and something that we're going to spend a lot of taxpayer money in the next couple decades trying to find out. Let's go back to Mars. Mars has had a lot of interest lately because there was a report in 1996 of evidence for life in a Mars meteorite. Unfortunately, we now know that any time a meteorite ends up on Earth and has been here for any length of time, it gets almost instantly contaminated with stuff from the Earth. And so you see stuff in that meteorite, but you're being fooled if you think it came from elsewhere. It's just our own stuff sort of complicating the picture. So the Mars meteorites, unfortunately, are very compromised by their presence on the Earth. So one of the major efforts of the next decade by NASA is to explore Mars in a very rigorous way and search for evidence of life. And luckily, I've been at the forefront of this. Gee, sorry about that, folks. And I've been working on instrument designs that could test the possible presence of organic compounds associated with life directly on the surface of Mars. And this instrument, which we call MOD, for Mars Organic Detector, was selected for the 2003 mission. It was selected about Thanksgiving time in 1999. And if you recall, the first week in December, the Mars Polar Lander disappeared. So the good news is I was selected for a mission that has now been postponed to 2005. And this is a model of MOD. You see, it's an instrument that fits in your hand. This is actual size. It weighs about 2 kilos, so it's about 4 pounds or so, 5 pounds. And it consists of a couple of different elements. We have this will be right on the deck of the spacecraft, right next to a drill or a scoop that'll reach out, pick up a sample, and drop it into this device here, which is a rock crusher. That thing works by a series of very highly levered gears to simply crush that sample into a powder. That powder drops into this little oven right here, and this oven then seals at Mars ambient pressure, which is about 1/100 of the Earth, and Mars ambient temperature, which is really cold. And this oven heats the sample, and any organic compounds that are present in a sample are volatilized, vaporized, and condense on a cold finger that's sitting in this part of the apparatus. We then have ways to sense what's on that cold finger using various laser-based sensors. And with this, we can detect whether amino acids, the compounds that are part of proteins, are present in a sample from Mars, directly on the surface. We also have a little device here that's a spectrometer, a tunable diode laser spectrometer, that allows us to sense what kind of minerals are decomposing as we heat this sample. Now, this device, as it was selected for 2003, would only tell us whether we had amino acids in a sample and at what level. Since the mission has been postponed for 2 years to 2005, we've been given another challenge to go beyond that and do analyses of the amino acids directly on the surface and determine their handedness. Now let me go back to give you a little biochemistry. Amino acids like Stanley made in his experiment can have two different properties called handedness, the left and right hand forms. In Stanley's experiment, you make equal amounts of the left and right handed forms. Organisms on Earth use only left-handed amino acids in their proteins, a very distinctive signal of life. Both of them present, that's natural chemistry. Only left-handed amino acids, life like on Earth. We think that life elsewhere would choose one or the other, either left or right. So the next stage of this device, as it goes to Mars in 2005, will be to look for the handedness of amino acids. Now, what would be my fantasy? We find right-handed amino acids on Mars. Remember, they're left on Earth. Right-handed amino acids on Mars would say unique Martian life. Now, what about if we found both? That could mean chemistry like Stanley carried out in his experiment. It could also mean stuff falling on the surface like the Murchison meteorite stuff. How about if we find L, or left-handed? Well, remember I said it's by chance that you get one or the other. So you flip the coin twice, maybe you come up with left-handed twice. Or maybe we're related. So I'll leave it there. You have anything more, Chris? Or?
Not really. I think...
Why don't we open it up for questions?
Absolutely. Then? Good idea. Did life originate in the deep sea? As you know, there are fascinating things in the deep sea, including such things as hydrothermal vents. You can learn about them at the aquarium here. These are upwellings of hot water that's heated by a very hot volcanic rock at some depth in the ocean. These upwellings of hot water carry with them compounds, in particular sulfur rich compounds that can be used by bacteria to grow. And these bacteria then will multiply, and they are actually the food source for quite a variety of different, more elaborate organisms, like worms and crabs and so on, that dine on either the bacteria or on the other creatures that live on the bacteria. So this is a self-contained ecosystem, a self-contained collection of living organisms living way down at the bottom of the ocean. We know, though, that the bacteria in these hydrothermal vents are very much like the bacteria you find in other parts of the world. We also know that the organisms, the bigger organisms living in these vents, have relatives in the shallow waters of the oceans. So it's not obvious. There is no direct evidence that life could have arisen at these hydrothermal vents. If we were to find an extremely primitive form of life living in these vents, I think that would make stronger evidence. But at the moment, at least, we don't know where it began. Jeff and I suggest in the book that life probably happened on the surface of the Earth because there was more going on the surface. Wave action, tidal action, the kind of repeated changes that happened on the surface of the Earth would probably have helped life to evolve. But otherwise, you know, it's really anyone's guess. It could have happened way down there. It could have happened on the surface. We think it might have happened on the surface, but we could easily be terribly wrong.
He asked whether the Murchison meteorite, in fact, was suggestive of hydrothermal-type processes. And in fact, the Murchison meteorite looks to be very much like a 25 degrees centigrade broth that simply underwent some sort of processing. There's no evidence of high temperature involved with the organic compounds in that meteorite. One of the things that's important in the synthesis of amino acids is, in this experiment, is hydrogen cyanide. And you heat hydrogen cyanide and it decomposes like a shot. So you don't want to heat it. What happens to meteorites when they enter the Earth's atmosphere? Don't they get heated and everything obliterated? This is an interesting question because... certain meteorites, because of their size, actually get what's called aerodynamically braked in the atmosphere. Something on the order of a meter or two will actually be slowed down to the point where it soft lands, so to speak. And Murchison, when it fell in the, early morning, late afternoon, or early morning. It was still very cool, and... it turned out the meteorite was still icy. It had it was very cold to the touch. Now you get bigger, and you get objects the size of asteroids hitting the Earth. The whole darn thing is vaporized. But we also have evidence that even in this kind of catastrophic process, some organic compounds can survive. So the question was, would there be any amino acids at the time of the Big Bang?
Or any sign that might have produced a sign of life at that time?
The answer is no. I think we could pretty much say no. At the time of the Big Bang, the only things that were present was hydrogen and some helium. And as stars formed, this hydrogen was processed by a process called hydrogen burning to helium. Helium then was processed by helium burning to more complex elements, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, whatever. And so it was only after you had several episodes of stellar evolution that you could start producing the building blocks to make organic compounds.
Okay. The question is it possible that life, if I have this right, is it possible that life could have arisen not on the surface of rocks, but in the vapor phase, in the gaseous part of the atmosphere? This is an interesting question because there are planets, for example, that have a huge atmosphere and no solid ground underneath it, at least not unless you get way, way down. Jupiter is a good example of this. A huge, thick atmosphere. Is it possible that living organisms could have evolved on Jupiter and sort of floated around like little balloons, you know, never landing, never going up too high, essentially just floating around indefinitely in the atmosphere? This has been suggested. Carl Sagan, among other people, made this suggestion a number of years ago. A fascinating idea. No evidence for it, but it's not, I suppose, impossible to imagine this could have happened. I would guess that in order to get started, you'd have to have little droplets of something in the atmosphere, little globules on which life could have begun. Something for them to accumulate. Otherwise, you know, it'd be all over the place. It wouldn't be able to concentrate stuff.
Let me just add, too, that the Huygens probe, which is scheduled to pass through the atmosphere of the moon of Saturn, Titan, will take place in 2004. Now, there are some people that have speculated on the existence of very bizarre creatures living in the atmosphere of Titan. I find that more science fiction than hard-based science. But we'll at least have a glimpse of another world, which could have some undoubtedly very interesting chemistry. I doubt if there's anything that's been generated that we call living, but interesting chemistry for sure. Yeah, well, number one, the Viking lander in today's dollars cost about $1 billion. So if NASA had the funding, we could refly Viking, and all of us in this business would be very, very happy. The reality is that we have missions that we have a budget of about $50 million. And so inherently much simpler instruments. Now, Viking landed two places on Mars. It carried with it an instrument called a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer. And that is an instrument also designed to look for organic compounds. And Viking looked at several soil samples and found no organic compounds above a level of one part per billion. That means a billionth of a gram in a gram of soil, of amino acids or what have you. Now, that sounds like a pretty damning result with respect to the possibility of life on Mars. But let me tell you where we now are at with respect to what Viking missed. It turns out, and we just have a paper that's under consideration about this, if you have a soil sample that has up to a million or more bacterial cells per gram in it, Viking would have missed that. So what Viking really did was do a highly sensitive analysis that tell us that the Martian soils aren't oozing organisms, but it doesn't tell us that there aren't million bacterial cells per gram. So we still have to keep a very open mind here. Padoga, la batoba, una, get you, got a padoga, la batoba, una, get you, got a padoga, la batoba.